From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, America's first Ebola death, same-sex marriage, and the Supreme Court, another shooting in St. Louis, ISIS, and Kobani. Liberian Thomas Eric Duncan became the first Ebola victim to die in America, Dallas. CDC Director Thomas Frieden.
We think about this and we remember what a deadly enemy Ebola is and how important it is that we take every step possible to both protect Americans and stop the outbreak at its source.
The Supreme Court waves gay marriage through in five more states, legal in 30 now, including Utah. Here's Utah's Cody Partridge.
This is a day of celebration and victory for all of Utah, for all families.
And outcry in St. Louis over the shooting death of a black teenager by an off-duty police officer. Police say he had a gun. Family says he was holding a sandwich. Here's Van Jones on CNN.
If the facts are true that this person's shooting at a cop, nobody should support that kind of action. But nobody now can trust what law enforcement is saying, and that is a tragedy.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Karen Tumulty, Phil Stewart, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? St. Louis, Ebola, Kobani, Pakistan's Malala, and her Indian co-winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, Kailash Satyarthi? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
Great to be back. Thanks, Tom.
Also from Washington, Phil Stewart is with us, Pentagon correspondent for Reuters. Been doing some great reporting there on Syria, Iraq, Turkey, and more. Phil, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Karen, and Phil.
We've got so much to look at today, but if we may, let's go first to this little town of Kobani, right on the Turkish border there. We went and talked with folks in Kobani a week or so ago. ISIS was coming. The Islamic State was coming. Everybody could see it. They've continued to come, really bearing down on this town. It's become a kind of watchword for whether or not the strategy's working or on what kind of timetable. Talking with reporters during a meeting with the British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond in Washington, this was on Wednesday, Secretary of State John Kerry said the coalition cannot rush in to rescue Kobani.
As horrific as it is to watch in real time what's happening in Kobani, it's also important to remember you have to step back and understand the strategic objective.
Step back and understand. Phil Stewart, that may be harder for many in the world than it seems to be for John Kerry. What is playing out here, Phil?
Okay, well, listen, there is a U.S. strategy for dealing with IS, Islamic State, but it's a really long-term strategy and one that's probably going to test the patience of the coalition members in a substantial way if these limits that the United States and others have put on the campaign are going to remain in effect. And although, you know, Kerry and others are saying that it's not a strategic value, there were more airstrikes just announced today. And then also yesterday, and I think we're looking at a total of around, you know, a third of the strikes in Syria since the campaign began have been around Kobani. So it's hard to kind of make the case that it's not of any value.
You know, we talked with a Kurdish leader inside Kobani last week, and we talked with him again just today. This is Idris Nasan. He's been watching ISIS move closer and closer, move in. He said, yes, there are airstrikes day and night now from the coalition, but he says they're not going after the most important ISIS assets. Here he is speaking with On Point today from inside Kobani.
What do they target? Do they target, you know, heavy weaponry? Do they target fighters of ISIS? So we have to ask the international coalition leaders, what have they done till now? What have they targeted till now?
And here from inside Kobani again today, Idris Nasan talking with On Point. You'll hear the sounds of cooking and crying children behind him inside Kobani. He's calling here for a humanitarian corridor so civilians can get out before ISIS arrives, he says, to kill them.
Letting this town to be under control of the worst terrorist organization in the world will be very bad point in the history of humanitarian around the world. When they saw falling of Kobani and how ISIS is going to behead, you know, a lot of people and rape and, you know, they rape their women and destroy their houses and properties. No one will forgive himself.
Karen Timothy, long-term strategy here, Phil Stewart says. The administration, of course, says. But this is going to play out within easy camera sight of the Turkish side of the border, Karen. How, I don't know, how does this play? And I hate to even ask it that way because these are real lives at stake.
Well, there are two big questions, one sort of short and midterm and one long term, you know, and that is Turkey itself has a big military and it's there within sight of this.
Ranks of tanks lined up right across the border, not moving.
Exactly. So what are those negotiations like? And then number two, what does this say about the kind of long-term promises that President Obama has made here, which is that U.S. ground troops will not be involved in this fight?
I mean, here was an interview with CNN's Christian Amanpour on Monday. Turkey, protests all over the place, a couple of dozen nearly dead in these protests, many of these led by Kurds saying, get in there and help. But, of course, the Turks and the Kurds have a very fraught relationship. This was the Turkish prime minister telling Christian Amanpour that Turkey would only send in troops if the U.S. agrees that the coalition will go after Bashar al-Assad.
Turkey, under certain circumstances, is prepared to put boots on the ground in Syria.
If others do their own part.
So if the plan would be to also degrade the Assad regime, that's one of your conditions.
Of course.
Phil Stewart, bring us up to date here. First, on the U.S. strategy, I'm reading this week, the Pentagon saying it's going to be another 5 months before they're even recruiting, before they start training up an alternative here. And then there's Turkey, which could get in but isn't because it says this all isn't focused enough on Assad. How do these things get resolved?
Well, you know, I don't know if they will in any kind of meaningful way. I mean, you've got a campaign of airstrikes that hasn't been able to stop the advance of this group.
Neither here in Syria or in Anbar, as far as I can see.
That's right. Yeah, they're making gains in Anbar. So you have a situation, but they're not in necessarily eyeshot of the cameras along the Turkish borders. This is all within what's happening in Kobani is in plain view, and that's really the big question for me is as I watch this. Will the possible atrocities, a lot of the cities emptied out, but will the possible atrocities that happen force a change in the strategy? Will they force the world to say, listen, we're not doing enough here? And that's really a big question because, you know, what's happening in Kobani doesn't seem to have it has a lot more value to IS, I think, the Islamic State right now.
But I don't even see what would the change in strategy be. The U.S. is not going to put boots on the ground as far as I can see. They don't have anybody else trained up. Turkey won't go in under these. What's the available change in strategy?
You know, it's unclear. There are things that, you know, they could theoretically do, speed up training or arming of some folks. Turks could let fighters across the border. They could Kurds across the border. They could allow the U.S. to use its base at Incirlik to launch attacks into Syria. That might help. But you know, fundamentally, the Pentagon is saying that they can't do much without a Western-backed, trained force on the ground to take advantage of the space given by these airstrikes. And that is going to take a very long time. They're putting it way out till the end of next year.
Jack, just take Kobani. I mean, the Islamic State forces, ISIS forces, in at the edge of town at least. Pretty soon, if you're bombing them, it's the old thing, you know, you have to destroy the village in order to save it. They'll be in it. It's the Islamic State now. I'm sure you've seen this, Jack. They're crowing. They're saying
yes. The
coalition is a bunch of losers. Who's going to want to join their army? They won't. What do you see happening here, Jack?
Yes, you know, there's a strategic and moral debacle here. I mean, the strategic one is clear. We did not work out anything with the Turks in advance. We seem to be surprised that they have interests that are contrary to ours. We seem to be surprised that they seem to want the Syrian Kurds destroyed more than they want to contain ISIS. And now we have the spectacle of our ally in NATO essentially bargaining with us, saying, well, we might do something if you give us a buffer zone in the north of the country, and they seem to want that because it's something, for strangely enough, the Syrian Kurds are are uneasy about. And then so that's just a major strategic confusion. And I think ISIS has taken advantage of it. They're trying to split the coalition by going after this town. It is strategic in that sense. And secondly, the moral part. I mean, my God, we're going to be in the air looking down, and our cameras across the border are going to be showing in real time the slaughter of who knows how many innocents, and we're going to stand by, and all of this is going to be under the canopy of President Obama's doubtful promise to destroy ISIS. And it's all of this because of the Syrian component of this strategy. It has just grown beyond the ability of the administration to think it through. And how ironic that this week, former Secretary of Defense and CIA Director Panetta should be criticizing the president for being overly cautious. Well, the one place he hasn't been overly cautious, he's paying for it now, and so are we, and so are the people on
Karen,
the ground.
I hear you there. Karen, yes,
but
please.
But I was just saying, but one thing he hasn't been is overly clear. And essentially, you know, Congress left town to go home and campaign, and without really debating this either. Essentially, they shrugged their shoulders and said, whatever.
It's on your plate.
And so I think that, you know, I think that as people pay attention to this, they are going to demand, you know, Americans are going to demand a much clearer idea of what we're trying to accomplish with this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news: Ebola, gay marriage, another St. Louis shooting, Nobel Peace Prize shared by a young Pakistani Malala Yousafzai, and an Indian counterpart, Kobani Panetta, Kim Jong-un. Phil Stewart is with us, Pentagon correspondent for Reuters, Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Jack Beatty is here. You can join us. Leon Panetta was head of the CIA. He was head of the Pentagon, the Defense Department, under Barack Obama, President Obama. This week, out with a book, critical of the president. He talked with MSNBC's Andrea Mitchell on Tuesday, said that, here's his criticism of the president's foreign policy handling and more.
He approaches things like a law professor in presenting kind of the logic of his position. And there's nothing wrong with that. You want to have a president who thinks through these issues. But my experience in Washington is that logic alone doesn't work. That once you lay out a position, you've got to roll up your sleeves and you've got to basically fight to get it done.
Karen Tumulty, what do you make of the timing, the fact of, and the substance of Leon Panetta's sort of parting shots here, beyond parting, I guess, but shots?
Well, my colleague here at the Washington Post, Dan Balls, wrote a column the other day saying that, you know, the president needs to listen to Leon Panetta. There is just about nobody in public life, I think, who has served in, you know, so many roles at such a senior level. He was, you know, head of OMB and White House chief of staff in the Clinton years. He was brought back to run the CIA and the Defense Department in the, you know, in the Obama years. He was denounced by Richard Nixon when he left the Nixon administration. He is just a man with just an amazing amount of perspective on how things should be run and on leadership. He's seen just about every style in the time that he's been in public life.
Do you hear malice in these comments, or just, I mean, nobody wants to be criticized by a former top colleague while they're still in the White House. I read this week, you know, why do you think Rumsfeld was kept on so long in the Bush administration? So he wouldn't get out and throw grenades back. Karen?
Well, I suspect they were very surprised by what was in this book, but it also echoes, you know, other things that we've heard from other people who've been in the administration, including Robert Gates, the former defense secretary.
Even more critical than Panetta. Jack, what about Leon Panetta's criticism here? Fair at this point? And what about the timing?
The timing is most unfortunate for the president.
I mean, Joe Biden said, Jack, forgive me, but he said, you shouldn't be doing this while, you know, the guy you served is still in office. I'm sorry, Jack, but here's his VP saying Leon Panetta is making, you know, out of line here.
Yes, and some people are saying this is a failure of the president's because he doesn't bind people to him in a kind that kind of moral, emotional way that would at least make them delay their publishing schedules. And you know, people have raised the other question about Mr. Panetta, about retrospective candor like this. Well, what about candor in real time? I mean, could he have raised these questions if they were serious enough, I gather, about aiding the Syrian rebels and perhaps keeping forces in Iraq, difficult though that would be, both would be. If he was so serious about those things, he could have threatened to resign. He could have, you know, made it an issue of print, didn't, and now he's writing a book about it.
But there's something in his argument here. Logic enough isn't alone. Logic alone isn't enough, excuse me. I mean, I think people are going to hear that and say, you know, President Obama should listen to that, as Karen Tumulty says. Ebola, huge in the headlines this week. The Liberian, 42 years old, came into this country, went to hospital in Dallas, wasn't diagnosed, came back, died this week. Thomas Aaron Duncan, Eric Duncan, sadly. Big cries going up around the world about the pace at which this crisis in West Africa and now very much on the minds of Americans is being addressed. Here was the president of Sierra Leone, who was in New York yesterday for an IMF meeting, saying the global response must be geared up quickly and dramatically.
Our people are dying. Children are being orphaned. Most of the dead are women. The general international response has up to this moment been slower than the rate of transmission of the disease. This slower than the virus response needs to change.
And the virus spreads. Here's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon.
The West Africans are scared. They need our urgent help. The world fears Ebola too. That is why we are here. The best antidote to fear is an effective response.
The best antidote to fear is an effective response. Where is that? Paul in Topsfield, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Paul. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. We were told before Ebola even came to this country, we were told by the top healthcare officials that the healthcare system could effectively deal with it. And then we saw the nothing but incompetence in that Texas hospital. And now we have this new policy at the airports of screening people as they get off the planes with to see if they have a fever, and they fill out this form. Well, that will be completely ineffective as well because this virus has a 21-day incubation period. People may not show a fever. How do you separate a person with influenza that has a fever from Ebola? People that has a fever. They could lie in the form like that Liberian fellow did. I have very little confidence that the healthcare system will deal with this in an effective manner.
Paul, we've got that. You're looking on from the Northeast and seeing that. We heard the same kind of concern with a kind of class and race angle on it right out of Dallas after Thomas Duncan's death. Community leaders in Dallas questioned the care he had received, compared his treatment to other Ebola patients. He was one of them on CNN.
He was turned away from the hospital. He was given an experimental drug at the final hour. His family was locked in an apartment for 9 days with toxic materials. So, and to top it all off, he wasn't given a blood clot treatment, nor was he allowed to video chat with his own family. To me, there are some discrepancies when we have people that have survived from Ebola in America. Why couldn't Mr. Duncan have survived?
An unhappy voice there out of Dallas. Karen Tumulty, what do you see emerging here? Some of the projections in West Africa, we heard on this show, Laura Garrett saying in this week that we could see almost 1 million deaths by February. It's a mind-boggling number. I don't know if that's true, but if it gets that big in West Africa, how do we keep a lid on it here?
Well, one of the most horrifying things I think that we've seen is that, you know, we have this gigantic international health structure. You know, we have all these international organizations. But what we don't seem to be able to provide is basic know-how and materials at the front lines. And, you know, the caller is far from alone. There was a Pew poll this week that said 32% of Americans are fearful that they or their families are going to contract this disease. There have been 5,000 false alarms about Ebola in emergency rooms across the country. So, you know, that just kind of the mismatch between the fear and the alarm and the capabilities of dealing with it has just become so apparent during this.
Trudy in Framingham, Massachusetts. Trudy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show. I was very concerned yesterday listening to NPR. There was a show done or a piece done by Wade Goodwin, the reporter from Texas.
Yes, of course.
About conservative talk show hosts like Rush Limbaugh deliberately fear-mongering on the topic of Ebola, going so far as to accuse the Obama administration of deliberately and strategically wanting to infect the American public by sending troops to Liberia to help with hospital construction and by failing to secure the borders. One quote that I recall from the show was that people who are infected could fly to Mexico and then sneak across the border in Texas and infect Americans. I find this kind of rhetoric alarming and quite disturbing, to the extent that Republican politicians are echoing these themes. And I wonder, to what extent is this being challenged and can it be exposed for the fraud that it is?
Trudy, I appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, there's clearly a real concern here, a real problem in Africa that's come to this country. There's also a very exploitable stew here, Jack. I mean, the same show where we heard this very large projection of potential deaths in Africa, we also heard that likely ultimate total number of deaths in this country might not be out of double digits. That's much, much smaller. And yet, it's got this political head of steam, this cultural head of steam. And with this president, yes, some talk radio hosts have taken it back to the Africa theme, Jack.
Yes, they have. And today, the front page of the New York Times picks up on Trudy's point. A political memo, cry of GOP in campaign, all is dismal. Looking for a theme in ISIS and infection, and they quote an ad being run by the Republican National Committee, evil showing Mexican terrorists allegedly streaming across the border. Evil forces around the world want to harm Americans every day. Their entry into our country through Arizona's backyard. All is fair in politics, unfortunately, and the media attention, which is, I think, warranted given how frightening this is, has and the Republican campaign are now coinciding, and I think that's somewhat unfortunate because it makes people more afraid than they need to be. You know, we are going to have a public health crisis in this country this fall. It's going to be flu. Thousands of Americans are going to die from it, and the public health service is not going to prevent it. We're not going to get the ads that would prevent it. That's something really to worry about. Ebola is serious, but it's not going to be a big problem in this country. Mm-hmm. That is for sure.
It flu's there every year, and people die. Yes, Phil.
Yeah, I just want to say, I mean, so I've talked to a couple of the troops over in Liberia as
who are there now, right? Just in the last day
now,
or two,
yeah,
they've landed.
Yeah, exactly. They've got around 350 folks in West Africa. Most mm-hmm. of those people are in Liberia. And what I'm hearing is that, you know, they feel pretty comfortable with their safety over there. They're saying, like, they're almost more worried about malaria. But what the way that this is playing out back home, they're concerned their families are getting kind of emotional, and that is one of the big issues for them. It's not so much, I mean, they are worried about their safety and they are taking precautions, yep. But the way this is playing out at home is a huge concern.
The idea of them returning as a vector of infection, you've got to be careful about ostracism here. Eric in Montgomery, Alabama, thanks for calling, Eric. You're on the air.
Thank you. It seems to me the media is not doing their job. They somewhere along the line, they think their job has morphed from telling the truth and trying to get at the truth to blaming Obama every time something goes wrong. Syria is a perfect example. This is a very complicated situation. People keep saying we should have armed the good Syrians against the bad Syrians, which Obama didn't want to do, and for good reason. Every single time we arm someone in the Middle East or in places like Afghanistan, those weapons end up getting turned around and used on us.
Eric, I take your point, but are you saying that if the absolute truth were told, President Obama would stand as a perfect paragon of leadership?
I think, let me just use the economy as an example, if I might, really
mm-hmm,
quick.
Mm-hmm.
The last quarter growth was 4.6%. The national debt has been reduced from $1.3 trillion when Bush was in office to less than $400 billion, which is what it is now. It's been reduced by two-thirds. The unemployment rate is 5.9%. And yet, out in America in general, the consensus is Obama's done a terrible job with the economy.
Eric, we've got it very loud and clear. Karen Tumulty?
Well, I just don't understand how you blame the media for this, quite frankly. People know what their own lives feel like. They know that the job that they have gotten recently is maybe not as good as the job that they lost during the recession. You know, we in the media print these economic statistics till the cows come home, but you cannot convince people that they should feel economically secure when they don't. And, you know, I've been traveling this country quite a bit, and I can tell you the economic insecurity is there, and it's there because of what people are feeling in their own lives. And as far as the criticism of Obama on Syria, President Obama, that has come from a lot of former members of his own administration. So, again, I don't see where the media is the problem here.
Jack, do you see an all-out, no-holds-barred, long-term attack on Obama coming to fruition in public disappointment or the president's own actions? I mean, you hear on the plus side, you hear Eric's laundry list of accomplishments.
Yes, Paul Krugman is out with a major piece in Rolling Stone saying, look at all the president has done. And he rolls out the accomplishments. He'll rank with FDR and LBJ and social policy, with health care, the recovering economy, general recovery of the auto industry, on and on, the banking legislation. But what Karen says is true. Existentially, John Q. Public doesn't feel that this has been a recovery. Too much of the prosperity has ticked up to the top 1 and even fractionally lower percent. And that's just, the president himself has admitted that. And that has made it very difficult for him to come out and say, look at this recovery. We're booming along. The recovery, the numbers show a recovery. And more people are getting jobs. But on the other hand, as everybody points out, fewer people are in the workforce. So it's a very difficult situation for the president to claim credit. I do think there is a quality in the media. It just happens that, we are, to paraphrase someone, a kind of herd of independent minds. I mean, there's a kind of consensus that forms. And my guess is that there's going to be a reaction, that maybe Krugman's piece will be it and will start it. And people will start saying, well, look at the evidence here. Because the media reporters can't keep saying the same thing. They have to say something new. Something new might be, this guy might be better than we think.
One more call before the break.
Steve,
in Londonderry, New Hampshire. Steve, you're on. Sorry, Karen. We'll go. Steve.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say, if you look at around the world at this point, you see all of the problems that are coming back to roost, and most of them are centered around this administration's lack of a coherent foreign policy. And it's stunning to me. I listen to callers come in and say how wonderful Obama is and what he's done and all this. And it's, he sat on his hands for 3 years with Syria. And then he tells the Iraqis that, it's your problem. You're going to have to deal with ISIS. And meanwhile, the U.S. caused that problem to begin with.
Hey, Steve, I take your point. But who took us into Iraq, Steve? Who? George Will calls it the greatest foreign policy debacle ever. Who did that, Steve?
I agree with you. In retrospect, looking at Bush, I think it was a mistake to go to Iraq. I think everybody does at this point. The U.S. has stumbled in the Middle East for years, and you can't deny that. But
no bouquet for President Obama from you, and we've got it. Steve, thanks for your call. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a nearly 40,000-year-old set of cave paintings, the clear silhouette of a human arm and hand, discovered in Indonesia, challenging long-established ideas about the history of human art and evolution. Maxime Aubert of Australia's Griffith University spoke from that cave in Sulawesi.
And the minimum age for that painting is 35.4 thousand years ago. That makes it the oldest figurative depiction in the world.
A very clear hand on the cave wall boggles the mind. In the name of children's rights, India's Kailash Satyarthi and Pakistan's Malala Yousafzai will share this year's Nobel Peace Prize. Torbjørn Jagland of the Norwegian Nobel Committee.
The Nobel Committee regards it as an important point for a Hindu and a Muslim, an Indian and a Pakistani, to join in a common struggle for education and against extremism.
A statement sharing there from the Nobel Peace Prize Committee and the multi-talented, charismatic, deep-voiced Jeffrey Holder died this week at 84. In the 1970s, everyone knew him for his 7-Up commercial.
Marvelous. Absolutely marvelous. Just try making something like that out of a cooler nut. Why, it's even prettier than a cooler. Nuttier than a cola, actually.
The cola nut. He made us happy in the 1970s. We're looking at a week in the news. Ebola death and screening. Gay marriage grows. Another St. Louis shooting. A Nobel there for Malala and more. Kobani, Panetta. Karen Tumulty joins us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Phil Stewart is here, Pentagon correspondent for Reuters. Jack Beatty's here. And we have seen another shooting in St. Louis that's getting a lot of attention. Angry protests erupting there for a second night Thursday in Shaw, a St. Louis neighborhood, after an off-duty police officer killed a teen who allegedly fired at him 3 times. His family saying it wasn't a gun, it was a sandwich he was holding. At a news conference yesterday, St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson responded to protests that erupted after that shooting.
I know emotions are high and I know tensions are high, but the reality is what we've seen, or what the evidence tells me right now, is an individual pointed a gun at a police officer, fired at least 3 rounds, and continued to pull the trigger.
17 shots from that police officer. Brittany Farrell lived about a mile from where the teenager, Vonderit Myers, was shot Wednesday night, told NPR she didn't think Vonderit had a gun.
One of the first things that I heard was 16 shots, you know, unarmed. They said he had a sandwich in his hand.
And here, Vonderit's uncle, Jackie Williams, spoke with NPR about the shooting.
They washed his blood away, but they can't wash away what happened yesterday. And we're hurt, and we lost our child.
I mean, the word, Phil, I realize you cover the Pentagon, not St. Louis, and not law enforcement, but just help us look at this. Ferguson, not far in the rearview mirror. This weekend, a lot of leaders gathering in Ferguson and St. Louis to still protest that killing, and here comes another. I mean, this is tough stuff, and I don't know if you've looked at this, but I'm reading the reports here that say the policeman was not on duty, but he was in uniform. He saw this young man. He attempted what's called a pedestrian check, and apparently the young man ran. The policeman pursued. Allegedly, shots were then fired, and 17 in return. The police there say a gun was found. But locals defending the young man are saying, no, it was a sandwich he was holding. How do we get something like this sorted out in a way that people trust, Phil?
You know, I think that the real number that jumped out at me in this whole thing is 17. 17 shots fired. That is a lot of shots, and it's going to require a lot of explaining. And I think you're going to see thousands and thousands of people protesting this weekend over this, and it's just coming on just months after this killing in Ferguson. So we've got a real situation. I don't think there's going to be any quick explaining.
There are facts to be determined here, but it's tough to do. And you hear the suspicion already. The police chief there saying, Jack, the male suspect fled on foot. Now, here's a police officer doing private duty, but in uniform, apparently. This is an extra security job on the side. The suspect fled. He was, when the policeman attempted this, what he called a pedestrian check, the officer pursued. The suspect turned, the police chief says, and fired a gun at the officer, fearing for his safety. The officer returned fire. And you've got a lot of very unhappy people, Jack.
You do. The officer, we read, 6-year veteran, served 2 tours of duty in Iraq, awarded a Bronze Star, Purple Heart, but 17 shots. My gosh, it does seem excessive. Meanwhile, of course, you've got this grand jury deliberating on the Michael Brown business and Officer Darren Wilson from Ferguson, and Missouri fears riots if that grand jury does not charge Officer Wilson, and there have been leaks from the jury. It's being investigated, but a person tweeted who says they're a friend with someone on the jury, who says the jury is not being persuaded that Darren Wilson needs to be indicted, and it turns out that this tweeter is also a supporter of Darren Wilson. So who knows, but it is a very scary business if this, I don't know what the facts are. I mean, there could be reason not to indict him, but it could have very serious consequences if he is not indicted.
This new young 18-year-old was awaiting trial on a gun case, but when confidence gets so thin, people even start to look at those. Phil in Augusta, Georgia. Phil, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
I just wanted to address your panel and bring up the component that he was an off-duty officer, and it's like another issue that's going on with policing our society. Is police officers taking second jobs as security or just wearing a uniform afterwards, like whether it be in San Jose where Ray McDonald was called his friend who's a police officer after he had a domestic violence issue, and the San Francisco Police Department chief had to actually suspend him pending investigation. Now, I live in Georgia, but I'm from Canton, Ohio, and I remember a similar situation to this, and all the off-duty, all officers were no longer allowed to have second jobs wearing their uniform. And I think that it's not just in Canton, Ohio, or in St. Louis, but all over America.
Phil, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Karen Tumulty, you know, you can feel a kind of allergy here in communities that feel that the policing has been too heavy, and then here it is, not even in public service at this point, but in a private job on the side, and still the badge and still the gun.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a line drawn from the first incident to the second one in the St. Louis area is really going to depend a lot on this gun that was recovered at the scene. And, you know, if it were me, I think if I were the police department, I would make sure that gun was examined by some outside experts to see how clearly they can trace it, you know, to this young man, because
people are saying plant.
Right. It was reported stolen 2 weeks ago. Again, presumably there is some clear evidence. And I think that at this point, the situation has gotten so tense there that people are not going to trust what comes out of, you know, the mouths of their own law enforcement agencies.
Let's go to Detroit. And Tom, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, okay. There's a lot of worrying things out there. What do you see, Tom? Okay.
Well, I mean, on the I'm not really going to deal with the actual shooting, but in terms of making kind of like, say, maybe some kind of resolution, mm-hmm. I'm the twice past president and the former president of the Police Community Relations Organization here.
And what does that mean, Tom? Is that a police organization or a community organization?
No. These organizations were byproducts of the 1967 riot or civil disturbance mm-hmm. Here in Detroit.
Yep.
And what it did was each police precinct has what's called a community relations organization, which is run by an elected board of citizens, and the police are part of that meeting, but they do not run the meeting.
Okay.
And, you know, they give reports in terms of, you know, crimes that have been committed and all drug raids and that kind of stuff. But what it does is it gives a chance to bring the police into the meetings, and the people, you know, they can, Tommy, Rock Hopper Tommy, see me, feel me, touch me.
Mm-hmm.
The police are part of that meeting. And, you know, you get a chance to meet with them. And we also here, we have what is called a board of police commissioners, which, again, it's an elected board of citizens, you know, that are elected to these positions.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of them are, you know, they're elected by district. okay?
Yeah.
And they handle, you know, police matters. And I think that Ferguson, you know, maybe they ought to send somebody here to take a look at it and, you know, to and wherever else they may be having some problems with police to, you know, hopefully try and bring about some resolve and some better police-community relations.
Sit down and talk. Tom, you speak with experience, and it sounds like wisdom. Jack Beatty, see me, feel me, hear me, touch me.
Yeah.
But you've got to have a core willingness to trust, to talk. I mean, clearly we need some mending on this front in this country.
Yes, and maybe it's the time for community review boards, as they've been called. I mean, police departments, they exist in some places, but police departments have resisted them. They say we do. We have internal affairs. We investigate our own. If you look at the statistics on that, the Boston Globe did pieces in the 80s and 90s on it. It's just, you know, 98% of the time they approve of what the officer did. That's not enough. The community, there has to be transparency, and I think this a move toward democratic transparency with civilian review boards is one way to heal the breach between the citizen and the police.
Karen, I want to talk about gay marriage and also what you see on the campaign trail for the midterms. First, gay marriage, kind of stunning move. Early this week, Monday, the Supreme Court stepped out of the gay marriage debate, at least for now, in a way, but it waved through. By not intervening, gay marriage for what, something like 11 more states now, Utah, Oklahoma, Kansas, Colorado, Wyoming, North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, West Virginia, Indiana, and Wisconsin, now 30 states where it's legal. Did you see this coming from this court, Karen?
I don't think anyone saw it coming from this court. And unfortunately for all of us, there was no explanation of why they decided to do this or, you know, who was on what side or if there was even a debate. But I must say, personally, I wondered, you know, whether the court was reflecting back on Roe v. Wade, because, you know, Roe v. Wade came at a time when a lot of states were liberalizing their abortion law. And what it did was really, you know, set off a social and political and moral debate that this country has never gotten past. And a lot of people, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg, will argue that that was a poorly written decision, one that, you know, actually stood in the way of progress in many ways for many people who favor abortion rights. So, you know, I do wonder if the court just sort of said, hey, look, we can see what's happening out there. This is coming, and we're not gonna intervene either way. Now, a lot of the conservative groups I talked to this week argued that this was just a feint, that in fact the court is going to come in with something more dramatic that actually pushes, that is a Roe v. Wade for gay marriage.
Meaning pushes back against gay marriage or supports it?
That supports it. And again, you know, runs, again, they say runs the risk of, you know, igniting this debate that the country can't get past.
I mean, in this week, there's a sense of done deal, over the hump kind of surge here. 30 states, that's a lot. Who would have thunk it not long ago? Karen, keep us out there on the campaign trail. Republicans gunning for a Senate majority. Your latest reporting says, Karen, that has seemed like sort of conventional wisdom that they're going to have it, and may yet, but this week some quavering. Karen.
It's interesting because, you know, this really has looked like a stacked deck, and to this week we find out there are some wild cards in it, and they're all in red states that the Republicans had kind of thought they weren't going to be having to fight. You know, one obviously is Kansas, where it appears an independent candidate could take out a Republican incumbent in a ruby red state, Pat Roberts. They're sending in, the Republicans are, everybody from Ted Cruz and Sarah Palin to Bob Dole to try and get him out. South Dakota, again, a state that everybody thought was so clearly in the Republican column, is again an independent candidate, former Republican Senator Larry Pressler. And the Democrats have decided to dump $1 million into South Dakota. And finally, Georgia is much, much closer at this point than I think anyone would have thought until recently. And that's in part because of some missteps on the part of the Republican candidate, David Perdue.
What about Kentucky and Mitch McConnell's race there?
Okay. Kentucky is, you know, everybody is watching Kentucky closer, probably more closely than any other race, just because it's Mitch McConnell. And for the first time, there's a poll down there called the Bluegrass Poll that people watch fairly closely. The news media organizations are in part behind it. And for the first time, it showed Allison Lundergan Grimes, the Democrat, up by a tiny, tiny, tiny margin. I would still put money on Mitch McConnell to win this race. But what's happening is it's not settling down the way people thought it would.
I want to give a couple of seconds here to these two Nobel Peace Prize winners. It is striking to have young 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai of Pakistan sharing the prize with the Indian who's worked for against trafficking and more in India, Hindu on the other side, Kailash Satyarthi. Here's Malala. We know her message, but it's a good time to hear it again.
I truly believe the only way we can create global peace and to our peace and prosperity is only reading, knowledge, and education.
And here, Indian child rights campaigner Kailash Satyarthi saying his and Malala's goals go hand in hand.
So the fight for right to education and fight for elimination of child labor has to go hand in hand. And since Malala has been fighting for the right to education for the most deprived children in her country, that will also make sense for the cause.
Jack Beatty, were you taking home a Nobel Prize when you were 17 years old? I know I wasn't. But how reaffirming to see children put front and center here make us think again about everything when you think about the children and the future. And these two help us do that, Jack.
They do. I mean, Malala really is one of the moral heroes of our time, our Nelson Mandela in some ways, and the Indian gentleman with his crusade against child labor in making rugs. This is about the future and children, and also about gender, about empowering women and about women's education in countries where that's banned. And it's just so heartening to see those causes affirmed.
Two inspiring people. Yes, it's a time with all kinds of trouble, but people are still standing up to do the right thing. And Nobel Prize Committee, Peace Prize, honoring them this week. Karen Tumulty at The Washington Post, it's always great to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today, Karen.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Phil Stewart, covering the Pentagon for Reuters. Great to have you today, Phil. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, thanks as always, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Have a good weekend. This is On Point.